Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Impeachment. Welcome to Inside the Hive. Impeachment. I'm your host, Impeachment Nick Bilton. Now, can anyone guess what we're going to be talking about this week? Come on, let's see if you can guess. Let's say it out loud together, maybe your answer, in 3, 2, 1. Impeachment. Now, the big question I have is, will the impeachment hurt or hinder the Democrats' chances of winning the election in 2020? Well, who better to answer that question than David Plouffe, who is the genius who ran the Obama campaign in 08. He was worked with the White House, the Obama White House. He is the guy who you're about to hear from, who literally thinks, eats, sleeps, drinks electoral votes and how to win campaigns. It's really, honestly, I don't think I've ever spoken to someone who understands this process better than David. He has a new podcast out right now called Campaign HQ, and what that does is he talks to people who run the campaigns that are currently going up against Donald Trump today, from Elizabeth Warren's campaign to Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, you name it. Our conversation today is truly fascinating, and it will tell you exactly what you probably are a little worried about and maybe give you a little hope for what is going to happen in the next 18 months as we lead up to the election. So without further ado, David Plouffe. Thanks so much for joining me today. This is probably the best week you could come on. I'm actually going to tell our listeners, we recorded this a couple weeks ago, screwed it all up, and I'm very, very happy that we did, because we get to talk about the impeachment, which is very exciting and fascinating. And I'm very curious to hear your thoughts on whether it's actually going to do anything. But I want to start with a question. In the beginning of your podcast, you say that this is the most important election probably in history. And when you look back at history and you see all the things that were going on every time there's a new election, it feels like they all are. But is this one different?
I think it is, Nick, and thanks for having me. This isn't simply, Republicans versus Democrats or different shades of policy difference. I mean, I think we are going to survive 4 years of Trump, although we'll be digging out for a long time. I'm not sure we'll survive 8 years. Our alliances may not. We may be fighting wars we shouldn't fight. I think, the fact that we'll have 8 years of president celebrating racism and misogyny, he is, blown up the deficit, the largest deficit since World War II. So his second term, no doubt, will be an effort to cut Medicare and Social Security very severely. So I do. I mean, I'm not sure we will like who we are after 4 years. It's going to recover from that. But 8 years, the compounding damage there, I think, is immense. We'll see ultimately. If around the globe we see this kind of irresponsible nativism recede, but if Trump were to win, I think certainly you're going to see also all around the globe more candidates just like Trump emerge. And so it's hard, I think, to fully calculate the effect of a two-term Trump presidency. Then let's get to the courts. I mean, we could have a 7-2 court, two more Kavanaughs on the bench. So maybe if that's all we talked about, that would make it one of the more important elections. Yeah.
No, that, I mean, I think that that's, to me, I think what's when we look at the impeachment stuff and we look at the courts and everything, and we'll get to all of this, what is so fascinating is like all of the things this guy has done, and he's still, and we're now, the thing that may take him down is like one extra thing he did. And I can't even comprehend what he would get away with if he won and got to serve another 4 years.
Oh, I mean, if he doesn't have to face the voters again, I mean, he already ignores our institutions, any sort of precedent in terms of how a president should operate. I mean, he completely ignores them defiantly. So we're going to see that increase dramatically. Nothing will hold this guy back.
All right, so let me ask you a question real quick. So
yeah.
One of the things, you had two sides of the aisle on the same aisle, of course, that were saying we should go and we should impeach him, and others that were like, we shouldn't, because if we impeach him in the same way you saw happen with Clinton, he has the Senate is not, you need two-thirds of the Senate to vote him out. They're not going to do this because it's majority Republican, and therefore he gets to say, look, you guys, you know, you had your Democratic House that did the impeachment, and look at the way it turned out, and it could completely backfire. What is your mind of how this kind of works itself out as far as the 2020 election goes?
Well, I think to me that's secondary to the process itself. So there seems to be more than enough grounds to begin an impeachment inquiry. And we'll see if we actually move to formalized proceedings. But if we do, it's because through all the testimony and evidence and research, that's the right thing to do. It's, you know, I'd be disappointed if we won the House in 18, and if we've got grounds to impeach a president, that they wouldn't do that. Like, kind of, what's the point? So we have to do what's right. I know that no one believes that. Like, everything is viewed through the lens of what's the right political move. But just like, for instance, who you pick for your vice presidential nominee when you're running for president, the far more important question is who would be a good vice president if you'd win, not whatever modest effect they may have in the election, which is generally none. So this has to be about the substance, the Constitution, what's right. But to speak about the politics, I think it's far too early to know. Here's what we know. No president wants to go into, first of all, the only president that went through impeachment proceedings in their first term was Andrew Johnson. Okay, that was back in the 60s. So 1860s, we can't draw many lessons from that. Nixon and Clinton were both in their second term, very, very different. So, you know, there is no playbook for this. But I think it stands to reason, even as crazy as Trump is, and he likes to dominate the oxygen and the discussion in the world, I'm sure he would not have designed this. So that's not great. I think more things are going to come out to probably give voters a view that, like, you know what, even if I like some things this guy did on the economy, like, we just, can't we do better than this? But I think on the flip side, Trump's using this very smartly already. He's running millions and millions of dollars of YouTube and Facebook ads, and maybe other platforms, to identify new supporters, register new voters, find new volunteers. So Trump is going to squeeze every benefit out of this. So even if at the end of the day, it's kind of a wash with swing voters in the middle. The question is, Trump may ultimately win the battle of who used this most to drive up intensity in their base. So I do worry about that, quite frankly. But, you know, now that the House has moved forward, and I think it was the right thing to do, they need to execute this all. The one thing they have to be mindful of is the stage management of this is important. So not stage management in terms of facts, but, you know, how you manage this day to day, hour to hour, because you got to understand, Trump is one person. And the most important thing in Trump's world is to get reelected. He cares much more about that than doing the job as president. But, you know, we've got House Democrats. Most of them care about beating Trump, if not all, but it's not their singular mission. They're members of Congress. They've got their own campaigns. We don't have an opponent against Trump right now. We got a gazillion people running around Iowa trying to be his opponent. So that's an advantage to Trump, too. They wake up each and every day, and it's easier to call your play because it's one entity. You know, so really figuring out, if it gets to hearings, who's doing the questioning, how you stage manage that, how you handle the press, what's the social media plan. So again, I'm not talking about the facts of the case, but the choreography around this is really important. And it's always easier when it's like you versus, you know, 230 people, which is the advantage Trump's going to have. So again, I don't know how it's going to play out, but for Democrats who feel like, oh, this is another nail in Trump's coffin, I'd be super careful about going there. Because, you know, Trump just reported, we're talking on Tuesday of this week, Trump just reported his fundraising numbers. It was off the charts. And he now has double the cash on hand that Barack Obama had at this time in 2011. So he's going to be fully resourced. They are really smart about digital and social media. I saw some ads over the weekend when I was just trolling around YouTube. Some of them were quite good. So they're going to get the most they can out of a bad situation.
You're scaring me. Sorry. I have a bottle of water with me. I should have brought a bottle of whiskey for this conversation. all right. So when you look at the potential outcome of the impeachment hearings, do you think there's a – I mean, look, this is total pie in the sky, you know, wishes and hopes and dreams. But is there a chance that we impeach him in the House and the Republicans are like, you know what, this is insane. We could impeach him and we still could keep, you know, our Republican vice president. We can kind of get through this whole thing, put it all behind us and do the right thing. Or is that just me being kind of naive and ridiculous and stupid?
Yeah, I don't think there's going to be any West Wing episodes in this impeachment episode, sadly. I mean, you got to remember, even back during Watergate, when the polls moved, not just of the general electorate, but of Republicans, Nixon was obviously getting pummeled day to day. I mean, half the Republican members on the House Judiciary Committee did not vote for impeachment. So things are like a gazillion times more partisan now. So, yeah, I'd like to think that if enough comes out, it's clear that A, these are high crimes and misdemeanors, and B, maybe at that point Trump is wounded electorally more than he is today, that some Republicans would step out. But I don't see it. I mean, I think the one galvanizing principle right now of this modern Republican Party is cowardice. And I think that's driven as it relates to Trump because his numbers amongst Republicans are still very, very high. But more importantly than his overall numbers of Republicans is, you know, the intensity of Trump supporters on the ground is really incredible. And that's going to be asset for him in the general election. So, you know, the notion that we'd have that many Republicans ultimately decide to sort of put party second and put principle first, I think is fantasy. Now, we shouldn't let them off the hook. And I think those that vote against impeachment, like if Susan Collins votes against impeachment in Maine, I think she could pay a price for that. But at the end of the day, I think here's what I think Democrats who are focused on beating Trump need to focus on. There are no shortcuts. We're not going to get a conviction. We're not going to get a resignation. We have to beat him in the election. And that election, even with his poll numbers as weak as they are, is going to be super hard because he'll overperform in battleground states. And the turnout is going to be astronomically high in this election across the board, which is good for democracy. But that's not all going to come from young minority voters. There are a lot of unregistered voters who look just like Trump's base, and the Trump campaign will find them, and they will register them, and they will turn them out. So any Democrat's going to have to beat Trump with exceedingly high Republican turnout. So that is the task in front of us. We should pay attention to impeachment. We should lob calls into our representatives. We should share content that we think is persuasive about Trump's crimes and misdemeanors. But we have to be focused on the election. I don't think this movie's going to end with some shortcut. We're going to have to take him out the hardest way possible, which is to get to 270 electoral votes in the Electoral College on November 3rd, 2020. And if we don't do that, we have four more years of Donald Trump. And that's what we have to stay focused on.
When you look at some of the battleground states, you know, I've written stories about this. We've seen stories, we've seen polls and everything that some of the states, you know, Texas could be purple, it could be red, it could be blue. We don't know. There's, you know, Georgia, Florida, all these things that are essentially that are in this place where more people are moving to the big cities. They are, of course, defining what these states become. The battleground states that we need to be kind of focused on, are those the ones that we're talking about right now, or are they some that we're not even kind of aware of that could swing the entire thing?
Well, my sense that, first of all, it's important to remind folks that, you know, the Electoral College, in terms of whether it breaks Republican or Democratic, is not stagnant. So 1976, which is, you know, not that long ago, you know, Gerald Ford won all of New England and California and Washington and Oregon, states that are all deep blue now. And Jimmy Carter obviously did very well in the South. And so these change over time. So I'll first talk about 2020. So we know that Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania will be core battleground states. I think you're likely to add Arizona to that mix, which is important because in a scenario where you don't win Wisconsin, which is 10 electoral votes, and you win Arizona, that's 11, you're kind of held harmless. I believe North Carolina, where we just won the governor's race, Obama won it once, lost it once narrowly, will be in play. And I hope Florida is. So Florida is a strong Trump state. a million more people voted in 2016 and 2012. Some of that did go to Hillary. She actually got more votes than Obama did, even though we won it twice. But Trump really surged his turnout. But Florida is always close. That's the one state, even as states change around us, you know, going back a long, long time now, close in governor's races or and Senate races, close in presidential. And with great registration and turnout, we can make it competitive. I think on Trump's side, he's going to try and make Minnesota a battleground state. And that was very close last time. I don't think it'll be a tipping point state, meaning the state that puts him at 270 if he wins, but I'm sure he'll want to contest Minnesota. And, you know, clearly they're going to look at New Hampshire, Nevada, New Mexico. I think the Democrats should be favored in all those, but Trump's going to want to expand the target area and target radius. On the Democratic side, in addition to Florida, I think they're going to have to look carefully at Texas and Georgia. I think the thing to remember, though, is, you know, if you get close to the Electoral College and you lose one of those states 49-47, a lot of good comes from that in terms of the organization you build, and maybe it helps some down ballot candidates win. But, you know, we've got to win the presidency, and 47 might as well be, you know, 27 if it's on the losing end. So our candidate has to, and their campaign has to be dead certain that there's a pathway to a win number, 50% plus one. Doesn't mean they'll get there, but they have to be absolutely confident that if they run a good campaign, if they have the kind of volunteers on the ground that they need, if they have the financial resources, that they can put that together. So you always want to put pressure on your opponent so that you are increasing your margin for error. We certainly don't want to get down to election night 2020 and we're basically competing only in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Florida, because then we have to win them all. And even if we do that, we win narrowly. I think we have a candidate and a campaign that can inspire people and motivate people and reach voters. But to do that, by the way, to put states in play like that, you're going to have to be able to win suburban voters, win back some of these Trump-Obama voters, and motivate young voters and African-American voters and Latino voters to volunteer, to register, to vote. So this question of, like, do we need a candidate who appeals more to the base or more to the middle? Quite frankly, a winning presidential candidate needs to do both, and they need to have a message, and they need to be of sufficient character and integrity and inspiration to do both. So I hope the battleground map is large, but that's the most important decision a presidential campaign makes, is what is going to be a core battleground state. And particularly as it relates to Texas, you know, that could be $100 million question. It's not cheap. So you better be sure there's a pathway to victory. And I know a lot of Democrats say, well, it'd be okay if we just get close because that means we're registering a lot of voters and we're setting Texas up for 2024. Same thing with Georgia. All that's true. But the presidential campaign has one job. Their job is to beat Donald Trump. That is, they're going to feel more pressure than I think most people can understand to get that done. And if they don't do it, in part because they made some bad resource decisions or some bad targeting decisions, that would be historically tragic. So we should all have some sympathy for these folks. This can't simply be about what's best for the party in the long run. They have to get to 270 votes. And if they don't, this election will be a failure no matter what else happens.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
America has a problem, one that is uniquely ours. On the new season of Long Shadow, I delve into the complicated history of firearms from the Second Amendment to the AR-15. I try to make sense of how we got here and how we might find a path forward. From Longlead, PRX, and Campside Media, in collaboration with The Trace, I'm Garrett Graff, and this is Long Shadow, in Guns We Trust. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
One of the things that is so fascinating is this, you know, you look at the polls, and when you look at the polls through history, how popular previous presidents were when they were heading into the elections, it doesn't seem to make a difference. Everyone, you know, for the last three presidents, for the most part, you know, Obama, Bush, Clinton, they were all kind of hovering around the 50% mark, give or take a little bit, depending on which week you looked at it. And when you look at the polls for the approval ratings of Trump, it's the same. It's, you know, maybe a little lower. It's in the, depending on if you look at like a Rasmussen versus an ABC poll or something, you know, he could be in the 40s, 45, 50%. Do you think that this is going to come down to a handful of voters in the country? I mean, one thing that's, when you look at the some of those states that actually did flip for him in 2016, it's thousands of voters. It's not a lot. And part of the thing that you've talked about a lot before is, you know, that how few people who had voted before voted because they didn't think they had the perfect candidate. We had, 91 million people who were eligible to vote who didn't even vote at all. Like, is this going to come down to, as it has in the past, just kind of how people feel that week when they go to the poll and a handful of voters that get to decide?
Well, first of all, I'd say on Trump's approval rating. Now, you know, we went through a period, when I was in the White House in 2011 with Obama, where our approval rating did dip, into the 40s, even the low 40s kind of during the debt crisis debacle. But, you know, it sort of began to climb back up. Trump, so Rasmussen is like some, you know, soft, cozy blanket for Trump to wrap himself in, like Fox News. Like, let's not. Rasmussen is complete nonsense. His approval rating, if you're the Trump campaign, is deeply alarming. And if you're a Democrat who wants to sleep easier at night, you would say, well, yeah, he's going to get good turnout, and yeah, he's going to overperform the national polls in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. But can he really win with an approval number that low? And when you do head to heads with him versus most of the other candidates, he's getting beat pretty soundly. So, you know, he's not entering the campaign the way you'd like. And his approval number has, it's always had a low ceiling. We've never seen this guy in any reliable survey bump up at the high 40s. I don't see that changing. So that is cause for optimism. But let's break down the election. So there's going to be, I think, historically high turnout. If we don't do that on our side, we're going to lose because Trump's, listen, the folks wearing the red hats with the white writing are coming out. And they're going to come out in numbers that are going to scare the bejesus out of us. So we've got to make sure we do a great job on turnout and registration, number one. Number two, we are going to have to win more of the persuadable vote than he does. And those voters exist in all the battleground states. People who are truly conflicted. There's not many of them, but in a close race, they can be, if not determinative, close to that. And then, we've got to make sure that the voters who aren't going to vote for Trump don't vote third party. You know, that's something that hurt Hillary Clinton. Those Johnson-Stein voters last time, she suffered a lot more damage from that than Trump did. And so Trump very much would like to win election in these battleground states, not having to get 50% of the vote or even 49%. You know, he won Wisconsin 47.2% of the vote. Think about that. He won Michigan with 47.8, if I recall, or 47.7. That's what they want to do again. So all of the work they're doing around the field, they're for infanticide, and they, you're not going to be able to drive your car anymore, or fly on an airplane, or eat a hamburger, and they're socialists, and they're going to raise taxes 100%, and they, are going to destroy businesses. All of that is done in service, not to get votes for Trump, in my view. It's to get enough people saying, man, I don't like Trump, I'm not going to vote for him, but I can't do this Democrat either. So I'm going to vote third party because I'm definitely going to vote. So every state, the presidential committee is going to have a view of that, which is what's our strategy to lower the third party number, particularly as it relates to voters that might vote for us. What's our registration number? What's our turnout number? And what's our persuasion number? And every state's going to be different. So in North Carolina, to use an example, registration and turnout are probably going to be a bigger part of the mix than persuasion. In Wisconsin, it's clearly going to be as important as registration and turnout it is. Let me just give you an example. So Hillary lost Wisconsin by, I think, 23,000 votes. She got 26 or 29,000 votes less than Obama in Milwaukee. So that's a problem. And you could say if we just get turnout back to where it was in 16, in 12, Hillary would win. Do any of us really want to go into the election with a margin of error of like 6,000 votes? That's the definition of insanity.
No.
So, in blue collar areas, in rural areas, in exurban areas, Hillary got 250,000 less votes than Obama in Wisconsin. So, let's try and get 50 or 75,000 of those people back. I'm not talking anywhere near even half of them. So it's a dangerous debate we have in our party sometimes about we have to choose. No, you don't have to choose. I mean, I've been part of winning presidential campaigns. You have to do both. And, the truth is in most battleground states, there's more conservative voters than liberal voters. The gap's closed, thankfully. And Republicans get their turnout much more reliably and much more easily. So the Republican sort of starts closer to the finish line than the Democrat does. It's harder for us to turn out our voters. It's become harder because of all the voter suppression activities Republicans are engaged in. And we've got to win the swing vote, win the moderate vote. You have to do both. So, and I guess, Nick, I would, you know, maybe Trump ends up falling apart. Maybe we head into a recession. Maybe even if we don't, by the end, the thing just breaks against him and he gets close to his approval number and we win a comfortable presidential election. That would be awesome. But I think we better prepare that it's going to come down to a vote or two or three per precinct. And why I don't think that's just, you know, trying to scare people is I do worry very much about the turnout Trump's going to get. They are a digitally sophisticated campaign. We talk about the unregistered voters in America, and there's no doubt there's a tremendously large number of them who are African-American, Latino, younger, but they over-index in states like California, in Illinois, in New York. So in the battleground states, there's a heck of a lot of Trump voters out there who look just like Trump's base who aren't registered or don't vote. So, you know, if you look back at 2004, John Kerry got a lot more votes than Al Gore did in 2000. But Bush really turned out every conservative voter you could ever imagine. It was kind of a feat that was hard to imagine. And my view would be we better assume that a lot of these battleground states in 2020 are going to be like Ohio in 04, that there's going to be a ceiling and it's super high and somehow Trump reaches it. So we have to match that. And I think we can. But this is where I think his approval ratings can give you false comfort. I mean, I look at them too sometimes and feel like, oh, there's no way this freaking guy can win. but when you kind of look at the votes he's going to be able to put together in some of these states, that's where it scares me a little bit.
All right. So I'm going to ask you to do a little bit of a PSA right now, because I remember going into the evening, we all remember, I think it's like, I remember being in New York on 9/11, and I remember the moment that I realized Trump was going to win. And I remember, you know, looking at the polls that day and thinking, you know, that week going into it, oh, he's going to be destroyed. Like, this will shut that guy up. We won't hear from him again. We can all unfollow him on Twitter and so on. And the polls were so drastically wrong. And they've been wrong with Brexit. They've been wrong with so many different things. And for a variety of reasons, technology plays a huge role in it. You know, sometimes some of these polling companies don't actually call people's cell phones. They call landlines. That's, of course, going to skew in one way. There's, you know, just there's a million different reasons this happens. And am I correct in saying, like, do not believe those polls when you see the, like, oh, Pete Buttigieg would win by 12 points or Warren by 16 or Biden by 9 or whatever it is? Am I correct in saying we shouldn't look at them too much and not believe what they actually say?
Well, I think that's always the best approach. You know, head down, nose down, and assume your opponent's going to do everything right and get every vote they can imagine. But, you know, the polls in 16, they did capture Hillary winning the national vote. I mean, I think, you know, on average, they had her winning by 4 to 5 points. She won by 3. And, you know, they definitely had it wrong in some of the battleground states. But it wasn't just that. The campaign's own models, meaning, you know, trying to predict how every voter was going to vote. Clinton's campaign obviously had her winning, as did Trump's campaign. I mean, Trump's campaign, you know, they were headquartered in New York. And my understanding is, you know, they went around and talked to all the news outlets and the networks, you know, as you do in a presidential campaign. That's kind of a tradition on election day, is you talk about what you think is going to happen and why. And, you know, their discussion was mostly around why they lost. You know, so everybody thought he was going to lose. So let's never be content again that we think we're heading into an election with false confidence. But there's a reason the polls were off in some of the battleground states. I think they understated some of the margins Trump would run up in exurban and rural areas. I mean, you know, there were some counties that flipped 40 points, okay, from 12 to 16. That's amazing. I mean, he won counties like Erie County in Pennsylvania that had been just rock solid Democrat for decades. So that happened. And then I think, you know, turnout was, you know, okay for us in some places like Florida, although Trump really exceeded his margins there. But, you know, obviously we suffered in places like Milwaukee and Detroit. It could have been better in Philly, but it was okay. So that was more patchwork. So yeah, I think if you could give yourself a lot of confidence, you say, look at these head-to-heads. They're all beating Trump in battleground states and nationally. And his approval rating's terrible. Like, let's just not screw this up, right? We're headed to victory. But again, what gives me concern is he's going to define the race. He's going to define the opponent. The gift he has is one of time. So our candidates are running on Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina trying to get the nomination. Trump's sole focus, his campaign's sole focus, is building a winning presidential campaign operation, defining his record, defining the race, defining the Democrats in the least charitable way possible. And he's going to be ready for the general election, much more so than our nominee is. He will be ready for them. He will have the high ground. You can never say that about Donald Trump, except in this regard. You know, they will have a better sense of the voters in Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania, in Michigan, in Florida, in Arizona, in North Carolina, even in Texas and Georgia, in Minnesota, than our candidate will. Because that's all Trump's doing. They're preparing that. They're understanding who they can register and what their volunteer operation looks like and who's persuadable and why and which voters may not be at all available to vote for Trump, but maybe they could push him to a third party. So, you know, Trump's got a lot of things on his side of the ledger, despite, you know, his sort of abysmal poll numbers and the fact that he doesn't seem to care at all about growing his vote share. I mean, everything he does every day seems to be aimed at his base. But again, that's not unimportant because there's a millions and millions and millions of unregistered voters out there who look just like Trump's base. And they're going to spend a lot of time finding them and turning them out, as George Bush did again in 2004 when he, you know, I mean, John Kerry got all the vote they thought they needed to win Ohio. And, you know, Bush still won by over 100,000 votes. So I do think that I just think the safest thing to do is to be happy that Trump's approval numbers are poor, to be happy that, you know, the head-to-heads don't look great. We can be happy about that. But that's very different than how the vote is going to unfold, you know, on election day and the early vote leading up to it. And the one thing I'm sure of is Trump will maximize his vote. He ultimately may not be able to get enough vote to win because he really has become such a hard place for, I think, true swing voters to land. I think there are enough of them open to an alternative. If we can close that sale, we should win. But he's going to maximize his vote. We know that. And as crappy of a White House as he seems to run, I think they're going to run a pretty good campaign. And I think we better assume that anyway.
Yeah, he's, I think that there's part of him who is a total and utter moronic idiot and a really terrible guy. But I think that he understands, as someone I've worked in the media for 20 years, he understands the way the media works better than probably anyone I've ever interacted with. I think that he just understands what is going to push the, I mean, it's what I find so fascinating, just this one little thing, is he tweets about himself in the third person. Donald Trump, President Trump, you know, this is unfair to President Trump because he knows that those screenshots are going to be put on the news and that people who are muted are going to be reading those screenshots of his tweets and they're going to understand exactly who it is. I mean, just those little nuances that he understands. And I think it's not to be underestimated as far as what they're capable of. And the digital stuff they're doing is, you know, we saw what they did last election. And they're going to be doing the same thing this election.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
All right, so I want to switch gears a little bit and take a little mini break from Agent Orange and talk about the Senate race. So in 2020, I think there's around 11 Senate seats that Democrats are eyeing that they're going to see if they can take over. There are some, of course, that are better shots, Colorado, for example, Arizona. You've got Susan Collins, who is thankfully going to be in trouble after voting for Kavanaugh. Do you think that there's a scenario where the Democrats can win back the Senate, or is that a tougher challenge than beating Donald Trump?
Well, there's a scenario, and a lot of that does depend on what happens at the presidential race. So, you know, we saw in 16, you know, Clinton, you know, did not win Pennsylvania. We did not win the Pennsylvania Senate race. You know, as a good example, she wins New Hampshire. We win the New Hampshire Senate race. So I think that these things don't travel exactly as mirrors. But, you know, if our Democratic nominee is winning Colorado by 5 or 6 points, that gives us a much better chance, obviously. If we actually win Arizona, Mark Kelly could win in Arizona. In Maine, it may come down to how competitive we are in the second congressional district. So even if our nominee wins Maine, as Hillary did, if Trump wins the second congressional district, like he did last time, you know, that may be enough to give Collins the boost to get over the top. So, but we have strong candidates in all those races. Obviously, Alabama will be tough defense. But I guess my view on it is we don't know. I think it's plausible. But the Senate's hard for us these days because Democratic support has, you know, really aggregated more in urban areas, right? So, you know, it wasn't too long ago we had two senators in both Dakotas, you know, and we could basically win Senate races everywhere. And of course, we did win Alabama with Doug Jones, great candidate, ran a great campaign, but obviously won under the most ideal circumstances, having Roy Moore there. We even saw that in 2012. McCaskill wins in Missouri in a tough race, but, you know, against a really flawed candidate, and things reverted to their mean last time, even though, you know, Jason Kander did, you know, do so well in 16, you know, against Blunt. You know, we saw that you know, the tide in Missouri was just too red for McCaskill. So I think the Senate's going to be hard for us because, you know, if you think about what's the most number of states a Democratic presidential candidate could win. Now, in a landslide, a lot. But in a truly competitive race, you're probably talking about 25 to 27. So you should think about that from a Senate standpoint. That's kind of our fishing pond. And maybe occasionally get lucky in another state because, you know, the Republican candidate's terrible or our candidate's just incandescent. But, you know, we've got to so Colorado, Arizona, Maine, winnable. Boy, we better win them because we're not going to get lucky, you know, in other places anymore. So, you know, over the long term, we have to have Democrats become more competitive in, you know, the plain states, in more southern states. But right now, you know, there's more states than not where all things being equal, the Republicans are going to win Senate races. So I think we're at a disadvantage in the Senate. So this is a cycle where we need to maximize the opportunity we have. We're not going to like where we are if we're winning half the, you know, battleground state Senate races that are truly battleground, that are in states that we, you know, normally win presidential races in, for instance. We have to really, that's where I think we have to have close to no margin for error, because it's harder for us to, I think, get to 50 in the Senate than it is Republicans. And so we're at a disadvantage right now just because so many of those plain states and southern states, again, have become more rock solid Republican. And, you know, we have a lot of excess votes. We obviously are winning, you know, hey, what's Trump going to get in California? You know, 33-34% of the vote. So a lot of good's going to come down ballot. But, you know, we're going to win those two Senate races. So I am concerned. I don't think that gets enough attention. Like, what is the Democratic Party ceiling right now in Senate races? And it's lower than the Republicans.
Do you think that there's a world in which Mitch McConnell can be voted out? I mean, I think that, you know, when you look at the most destructive people in Congress in the last 10 years, I think he's definitely number one. And, you know, his approval ratings aren't that great. You know, people in Kentucky are not huge fans of his. I know that he wins by a large margin just because of the Republican Democrat viewpoints there. But is there a world in which he could lose?
I would like to live in that world.
I mean, he's considered, you know, there's polls that say he's the most unpopular senator in the Senate. I mean, but what do you think? Is it a reality or is it just kind of daydreaming?
Well, I fear it's more daydreaming, but I think what is almost certain to happen in Kentucky is Donald Trump will outperform Mitch McConnell, maybe considerably. And so question one would be, what is Trump's margin in Kentucky? You know, if it's 56-44, you know, maybe our candidate can overcome that. If it's 60-40, that's harder. So there's just physics there that I think we have to account for. But he's as vulnerable as he's ever been. You know, I think that he's very, he's such a ripe target on being the definition of what's wrong with Washington, and not from a partisan standpoint, just from corruption and basically fully having gone Washington. So to me, that's really the question. Like, at what number can our Democratic candidate survive in terms of what Trump gets, right? And so my sense is that, you know, if it's 55-45 or 56-44 or 57-43, I think McConnell will underperform Trump enough that that then becomes a dead heat race. If Trump's winning at 60, 62, 64, I guess it's not out of the question, but think about how many voters in Kentucky then have to go Trump Democrat for the Senate. That's a lot.
Mm.
So that's my concern there. But you know, he's definitely as weak as he's ever been. I don't know if he's a pinata, but I think you can tee off on him back home. And because he's had some good candidates run against him, but he hasn't had the toughest of races for a very, very long time. Particularly in the modern digital age. So, if we have a great candidate emerge, I know we've got, Amy McGrath running. There's some other candidates, speaking of getting in there, who run a smart, sophisticated digital Kentucky First campaign. They'll make it close. So, the Jason Kander race is a great example. I mean, he came within three of Blunt, even as Hillary was losing the state, if I recall, by 14, 16 points. So there becomes just a point where, the tides are too strong. But what I'm excited about is, with data today and good polling and good modeling, the campaign down in Kentucky should have a pretty good sense of, okay, who are the Trump voters that are available to us? And that'll be a big part of the campaign. And of course, we've got the ability to drive big turnout amongst young voters and around among African-Americans. And I think for a lot of voters in Kentucky, they'll be as excited to vote against McConnell as they are against Trump. And that's quite unique.
Do you think that you just mentioned, all the polling data and the modeling and so on? It's as someone who covers technology, it's been fascinating to watch the impact big data has played on every industry imaginable. Is it, when it comes to these battleground states, to these, the way you plan an attack against someone like McConnell or Trump or something like that, is it playing a much bigger role and a much more accurate role now?
Yeah, so even though the models were off in 16, they were right in a lot of 18 races. I've certainly had the experience of models being more right than wrong, and just like in a private sector company, that's enormously helpful because you understand who your various audiences are. You're then more efficient with your resources. You're talking to the right people about the right issue. You're providing volunteers really good lists with great hygiene. So nothing's more frustrating as a volunteer to go out. If you're given a list of, hey, here's 12 people that, we think are persuadable in your neighborhood and none of them are, well, that's deeply frustrating. Or, 12 people that we think are at risk of not voting and they're all like, I voted for the last four elections, I'm voting. Like, that's really important to a good volunteer experience. So yeah, great data makes everybody smarter, because you're just operating with that level of intelligence and insight. But you don't want to cut it too, particularly with Trump. I mean, he's kind of a model buster. He gets the votes of people who maybe traditionally in most races vote Democratic. He also, provides opportunity with particularly like women suburban voters who might have voted even 18 Republican and voted in 12 Republican and 14, but just can't do Trump. So I think you have to have an expansive view of these universes. But, if you've got a good model and you're testing it a lot and it's proving out, it's just going to make you smarter. You're going to be talking to the voters you need to talk to about the things you need to talk to them about. You can also then think about what's the best way to reach them from an advertising standpoint. Most of that's going to be digital, but some of it can still be television and radio or podcasts. So it helps a great deal. So I'm a big believer in models. I'm a big believer in data. I don't believe you should be slave to them, and I think you should be constantly testing how can they be wrong. So in this election, I would always be giving Trump more support than the model suggests, just to be sure. If you think registration is going to be at X, I'd give him Z. And if you think his persuasion ceiling is Y, I'd again give him Z. Because I don't think what we want to do is undershoot the runway here and somehow model out an election that in reality is too easy for us to win. So I would definitely, make the degree of difficulty hard, when you're looking at your data. But, good models, again, whether you're running a consumer company or a presidential campaign or, a media company, the more you know about your potential audiences, the smarter you'll be. And that doesn't mean you should have 12 different messages for 12 different audiences. Like everything you say has to fit it under your core message architecture. But, you know, if somebody cares about healthcare and doesn't care about trade, that's important to know.
Okay, so if you have been on the ground, you've done this, you understand better than anyone I think I've ever spoken to, you know, how to apply your resources, both your candidate and where you're going to send them, given that there's only a certain amount of hours in the day that they can go somewhere and who they can speak to and so on. And of course, your, you know, money, like how much do you put to digital, how much do you put to traditional media? If you were, we won't say a name, but let's just say you were running the campaign for our Democratic candidate who is the nominee up against Trump. What's the strategy you're going to take with your resources that you have?
Well, I think that's a data, you know, driven answer. So you step back and say, okay, here's all the people we ultimately need to care about. So of course you don't care about everybody who's going to vote for you because a lot of those people are definitely going to vote and definitely vote for you. So who are your true persuasion targets? Who are the people you're trying to register? Who are the people who are registered that you're concerned might not turn out? And who are the people you're concerned might vote third party? So you step back from that and then you have, you know, to the extent you have some individualized data, but then you build models on that and say, okay, this is a voter who likely, you know, we should just reach through digital channels and this specific digital channel. This voter belongs to a cohort where television could still be important. Like I just was on my podcast, had Bernie Sanders campaign manager on it. They just started television advertising this week. And I asked him why, because, you know, they're sort of known as a digital first candidate. He said, listen, we clearly need to grow our support amongst older voters and we need to reach them through TV. You know, so radio still be important. Mail, you want to talk to everybody you can through volunteers. So it's data driven.
And what about states, the states that you really kind of focus on? Or do you go for...
And the same thing goes with time. The most important decision is actually not the financial resources. It's the allocation of the candidate's time. So that all throws through, you know, what are your core battlegrounds? And within that, you know, you have data coming in every day about how you're doing in the campaign. And, you know, when Barack Obama was in, Tallahassee in 2012 instead of Orlando, there was a reason for it. It's because we either saw problems or opportunity in our data. So you want to respond to that in the way you're spending money, the way you're allocating, your candidate's time and the candidate's family. So I'd imagine, you know, this time, it's October now, so this time next year, I'm sure the campaigns are going to be spending a lot of time and money in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, both Trump and the Democrat. I would suspect North Carolina and Arizona. I think the question then is Minnesota, Florida, Texas, and Georgia, did they become core battlegrounds? And if so, did they hang in there? Because, you know, you may make a decision in June or July that X state's a battleground, but if by October you just don't see a win number, you better get out. Like the worst thing to do is even though you'll get a bad press day, you know, so-and-so candidate decides to, you know, drop out of or reduce their spending, that's better than putting bad money after bad money. So that's the chess match, right? Which is, and the other thing you've got to pay attention to is when are people voting? So in states that have heavy early voting in October, North Carolina, Arizona, Florida, you're going to want to make sure you're spending a lot of time in those states as people are voting. Pennsylvania, traditionally doesn't have as much early vote. So you're going to spend more time there late. So you also have to build a cadence around the voting calendar. Registration deadlines. If there's a registration deadline in a state that doesn't have same-day voter registration, that's a core battleground. It'd be really great for the candidate to be there that day or the day before, you know, to remind people to register. So you have to be mindful of what's going on around you and not just have tunnel vision and make smart decisions based on that.
All right, we have time for a couple last questions. One of the questions I have is, I remember I once saw President Clinton speak, and he talked about how, in his viewpoint, people go to the polls for one reason, mostly. Some people go for multiple reasons, but, you know, you may go because of the weather that day. You may go because of some healthcare issue or whatever, or because you like this person more than that person. But it's usually one thing that you go to the polls for. Do you think it's kind of accurate to say that abortion is going to play a huge role in this election, given the fact that if Trump wins, you know, and he's probably going to get, if that's the case, he would probably get another Supreme Court nominee, if not two, and that could swing the vote on abortion. Do you think that that's going to be the thing that a lot of the people who will go to the polls that may not have normally done so in his favor or against him? Is that what they're doing?
Yeah, it's a great question. Now, first of all, most Americans are going to vote, you know, so you have a lot of regular voters. So I think as it relates to abortion or any other issue. So first of all, there's a category of people who are going to vote, but maybe an issue like that gets them to become involved, to volunteer, to contribute money, to become a precinct captain or a neighborhood team leader. So there's an intensity question, not just a participation question. But for the cohort of voters who may be on the fence, so think about that. There could be a young woman or a young man, you know, in the suburbs of Madison, Wisconsin. And it's, you know, 2 weeks before the election and says, you know, I hate Trump, but I don't really like the Democrat. You know, they're I don't agree with them on taxes or health care. I'm not sure, you know, so I'm not sure if I'm going to vote. Well, if you can determine that they care about choice, you know, that you can have a great conversation then. So if you're a volunteer on their doorstep to say, listen, I agree. Like, you know, I'm not wild about everything either. But what I know is it's likely that Trump's going to get, you know, a couple more nominations. So it would be a 7-2 court. Think about more Brett Kavanaugh's, and abortion will be illegal in the rest of this land. And so many women has health care issues now will be on the wrong side of history. So the only way to prevent that is voting. I think it's so. Yes, I do think the court will be a big issue. It will be a big issue for Trump, because as much as I fear, you know, a 7-2 court with two more Kavanaughs, you know, there's a lot of people in Trump's base who, you know, that'll be their rallying cry as well. But I do think it is not hyperbole. I'm sorry, it's not an exaggeration to say that the fate of women's health care in this country is going to rest on this election on November 3rd. And that should get a lot of people both to register, vote, and be intense. So but it'll be on both sides. And I think that's going to be one of those campaigns within a campaign that is going to be so critical. So that's a good example of whatever benefit we can get out of that: increased volunteer hours, increased registration, increased turnout, increased vote share. And we need to strive to get all of it. We better make sure it's more than what Trump's doing on his side, because that's an issue he clearly is going to try and leverage. So it's a great question. And again, it's important for people to understand that the vote of someone who's holding their nose to vote for your candidate counts the exact same as someone who's wearing your candidate's T-shirt and is volunteering.
Yeah,
they count the same. And so there's going to be a bunch of people at the end, for those of us out there talking to voters who are conflicted about whether to vote or who to vote for. Like, I'd be careful about, you know, saying, you know what, our candidate is going to be the best president in the history of the United States. You know, if you feel that way, great. There's a lot of people who aren't going to buy that. You know, a lot of people just want to know, like, I don't really like Trump, but I'm not sold on your person either. So maybe I won't vote, or maybe I'll vote third party. And all of us who are engaged with a voter like that better treat that like the most important conversation we've ever had in our life. Because if just think, if 10,000 people are having conversations like that in any given day, you know, over a period of days, that's like the margin in the election.
All right. So last question, you tell us a little bit about your podcast and who you will be interviewing and what we can learn more about as this nightmare continues to unfold in front of us.
Well, thanks for asking, Nick. It's called Campaign HQ, and it's available on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast. So I encourage you to check it out, download it, and subscribe. There's a lot of great podcasts out there. I mean, it's kind of like TV these days, like Netflix, Amazon. You hear every day about a podcast you're not listening to that sounds awesome. It almost gives you anxiety, right? So, you know, that's sports, it's entertainment, it's technology like you're doing, or politics. So there's a lot of great podcasts. So my first question I ask myself, is there something that's missing out there? And so what I'm doing in this podcast, I've had three so far. I've had on the campaign managers for Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, the senior chief strategist for Elizabeth Warren. So I'm going to have a lot of the folks who are involved in these campaigns, digital directors, state directors, delegate experts, folks who are expert in some of the allocation questions you've asked around schedule and resources, and bring the listeners a little deeper into the campaign. So it's less about, you know, what's going on day to day, or the great tweet of the week, or the great debate line, and spending a lot of time, let's talk about Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, you know, Joe Biden. What is their pathway to the nomination? What do they have to get in Iowa? How are they putting together their campaign to go the distance as we get into the bigger states in March and April? What would the battleground state map be for them against Trump? What kind of operation are they putting together? Where are they hiring their talent? So it's a deep dive. So if you follow campaigns closely, I think you'll like it. If you're just looking for kind of, you know, a quick bite or snack food about what's happened that week, that's not the place to come. But if you want to understand more, so my hope is folks who listen to my podcast, you know, will become experts on Iowa and the caucus process and the South Carolina primary and delegate allocation. And really, as we get into the general election, we've talked a lot in this interview about battleground states. That's all that matters. So for folks to understand a little bit more about registration trends and turnout trends and why, you know, in the general election, why did Trump go to Grand Rapids today? What's he trying to accomplish in Grand Rapids today? Why was the Democrat spending time and money in the panhandle of Florida? What do they see there? So really to go deep with a microscope into what I think matters in these presidential campaigns and expose listeners to the people who are in the arena right now, who aren't simply following the race, but they're actually making the race. And the ones, you know, kind of in the bunker. So that's what we're trying to do with the show, and you're nice to ask.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time. This has been fascinating. I'm gonna twist your arm to come back on once we get through the next few months and explain more to us. And yeah, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Nick. I'd be happy to do that. And, you know, by that point, we'll know what's going on with impeachment and who our nominee is and what the general election looks like. But my suspicion is it won't be much different than now, which is, you know, you look at polls and you'd probably rather be the Democrat than Republican, but you have an uneasy feeling that Trump's going to overperform them. And this is going to take just an heroic effort, not just by our candidate and their campaign, but all of us to make sure we depose the menace that is Donald Trump.
Hear, hear to that. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Nick.
Thanks to my guest today, David Plouffe. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. That's me. You can find these on Apple Podcasts, radio.com, or anywhere you get your podcasts. Don't forget to leave a review while you're there. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work. And thank you, of course, to my sponsors, The New Yorker and KiwiCo. Please support them the same way you support this podcast. And don't forget to go over and subscribe to David's podcast. It's Campaign HQ. You can find it wherever you get this podcast. It's worth every second of your earlobes. I will see you all next week.
Hi, I'm Michael Calori, the co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab.
And I'm Lauren Good, the other co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab. Get ready to dive deep into the cultural phenomenon that's been shaping conversations, sparking movements, and breaking barriers for over a decade.
The new three-part docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History, based on the groundbreaking Wired cover story by Jason Parham, explores everything from the fun, games, and inside jokes that characterize the early years of Black Twitter to the social movements, the voices, and the hashtags that made Black Twitter an influential force in nearly every aspect of American political culture. Join us as we unravel the threads of this digital community, tracing its origins, celebrating its triumphs, and exploring its impact on society at large.
Watch the series from Onyx Collective in association with Wired Studios, premiering on Hulu on May 9th.